I am Andreas Droulias. Today it's the 20th of February 2004, and I'm here with Michael Krauss to speak about the 1960s when you first came.
Yeah, the 1960s and the foundation of the Alaska Native Language Center. All right, we last time went over. I think my arrival here in 1960 and what I was hired here for and what the basic mentality of all of that was. And I will try to get more into my teaching of introductory linguistics, or not even so much that, but the result of that. Especially in that first course that I taught included two students, Irene Reed, who I did introduce, and Martha Tilak, who I also introduced. And the two of them were central in the student body of that linguistics course. And they lived together, they were next door neighbors in the apartment building I mentioned. And they, two of them, you might say, conspired to urge me to start up what was then, still now, I think, called Special Topics Course in Eskimo. And that course began in the very second semester of that first year, spring 1961, with six students, some of whose pictures you will see in the famous photograph that was published in the 1962 University of Alaska Fairbanks catalog, showing myself standing at the blackboard, transcribing along, you pick word, from Martha, who you can see facing the camera, and Irene next to Martha at the table there with the other students. And this was the very beginning of the teaching and modern program. At the University of Alaska, there having been, as I also mentioned last time, two very minor but very interesting bits before in the 1950s that I mentioned. I don't know what, if anything, was done with Gordon Marsh. But then Albert Heinrich, we have that little film bit of his one, at least one session of that kind. But there had been precious little linguistic work done as such at the University of Alaska, virtually none during the previous years of the university's existence. The Anthro department being closest to it and having being very prominent on campus as the major, most promising, until geophysics took over, you might say, research thing, making putting the University of Alaska in anything like the big leagues, you might say, for Arctic anthropology. But that never included linguistics in any meaningful way. And however, when it began in a different department, which to this day is never united with anthropology to do this kind of work.
Right.
And but ever since then, in another sense, you could say that the anthropology department could easily say, why should we bother with the linguistics? And in fact, we have a whole Alaska Native Language Center that is illustrious for doing just exactly that. And so our anthropology then can remain without linguistics. even though there are currently two linguists in the anthropology department, but whose work has little or nothing to do with Alaska Native languages, at least for the department. And there's a certain irony in that, and the whole issue of the relationship between the Alaska Native language work and the anthro is a major question and challenge for the university.
Can we make a little bit of break, because I don't get good signals from this thing.
Okay. For a living, I continued to teach the linguistics as such, and French, but began more and more this program with Central Alaska Nupik. In fact, in fall of 1961 and spring of 1961-62, we started a more or less permanent Yupik program with Irene and Martha taking more and more over the teaching of that. That became a kind of a program on its own. There was a lapse while Irene was in Seattle doing some more graduate work, but that did not turn out to be a really good idea, because couldn't be really relevant to what was needed most in Alaska. And so the Yupik program, it did continue with a lapse in the mid-60s, and resumed in the late 60s with Irene back, and with linguistics being partly taken over by people who could teach Japanese, and in this case most importantly by Far Osahito Miyaoka, who is still very actively working with this, with Central Yupik, and is a major leader of linguistics in Japan, including now too addressing the whole issue of global language endangerment, which is another subject that Miyaoka and I also share. But the with Miyaoka and Irene back, and other students, in particular Pascal Afghan, Joe Coolidge, and still Martha, the Yupik program gathered good steam. And we developed toward the later 60s, 67, 68, 69, a good practical writing system for Yupik, which is basically what is being used ever since, with some major or significant final improvements made in 1972 or thereabout by Jeff Lear. But this Yupik program was the beginning of what we would call ANLP, the Alaska Native Language Program, which is the teaching of Alaska Native languages. First of all, Central Yupik throughout the 60s, Yupik, Central Yupik alone. That develops, and we'll get back to that, along with other languages, into the Alaska Language Native Language Program. All of this was, however, at this time still, courses in the Department of Linguistics and Foreign Languages. In 1961 also, 1961, I wrote a proposal to establish a research program in Alaska Native Languages. This was never supported, of course, by the university itself as such, although it was encouraged by the university to get money from National Science Foundation, most especially, to do research on Alaska Native Languages. Already in that, I wrote with Dr. Wood a kind of proposal which is still in the files for a kind of thing which later did indeed materialize in the form of the Alaska Native Language Center. But more specifically, I got money, the first one on a grant to survey Alaska Native Languages from the National Science Foundation. I remember it was $38,000 back in 1960. That was not a trivial amount for a young fellow to get for the university here. And with that, I got a number of people working on a number of Alaska Native Language projects, two more or less duds, working on Atna and Tanina Athabaskan from the University of Washington grad students. Robert Austerlitz, who was the major linguist at Columbia for many years and head of the department at the time, who started working with EYAC. Irene Reed, working with Sukhpeak Alutek, first year in Prince William Sound, Chugach, and later in Kobuk, in Kodiak, the second year. Martha Tilak, working with her own Central Yupik and recording some superb storytellers and transcribing their stories from those tapes. And myself, starting working on Athabaskan in Minto and becoming very much primarily involved in Athabaskan, and though especially at Minto, and comparative Athabaskan, historical Athabaskan, revising immediately the Proto-Athabaskan reconstructed consonant system to include another series, the evidence for which was in Minto, the TR series is distinct from the TS series, in Minto and in Upper Kuskokwim and in Gwich'in and in Han and in Gaelic or Dekhetat, swatch of languages all the way through Alaska, which correspond to the PF series as opposed to TS in Tsotsiawitz, extinct language from the Portland Canal, which Franz Boas had heroically documented in 1894, and also in EYAC, where the TR Tsotsiawitz PF corresponded to English to EYAC K, while the other TSs corresponded, as expected, to EYAC CH. I don't mean to go into these kind of complex things, but it did require a major revision of what had been accepted for a long time as a reconstruction of Proto-Athabaskan. And I would say that my own public scientific publication and academic credibility or prestige for working in North American languages derived from that initial work with Athabaskan and the year 1961 at Minto and 62 continuation of the NSF survey in which I spent a lot of time documenting the basic developments of virtually all Alaskan Athabaskan. A lot of it done by field work, including some plane trips or long trips to places like Tulaida and Upper Kuskokwim, but also a lot of it done in the old Alaska Native Health Service Hospital on Gamble Street in Anchorage, back in the bad old days when there was still widespread tuberculosis epidemic, and all kinds of elders speaking virtually every language in Alaska were stuck in the Gamble Street Hospital with nothing but time on their hands, and very delighted to have someone come by and relieve their boredom by asking knowledgeably about the way they said things in their own languages, and they themselves could see and compare with each other and so on. It was a wonderful time that I had in that hospital, even though I always had to wear a surgical mask in front of my mouth, as did they in front of theirs, so that all of our communication was rather visually impaired and slightly muffled by surgical masks. That was certainly beat having to, what most people thought I must have dog mushed thousands of miles through difficult Alaskan conditions to have gathered so much information. And in fact, it was tragically simpler than that, and the people a lot more available under those tragic circumstances.
One note. Okay, that's the last one. So, yeah.
There was one other language that was, I discovered a number of things, including the need to distinguish more dialects, or what we now consider languages, that had hitherto been considered to be different languages in Alaska and Athabaskan. One of them was Holokechuk, which was still spoken at Holokechuk, and the only speaker I could find for Holokechuk was a man named Billy King, who was at that time not in the hospital with tuberculosis, but in jail. And the first documentation of that language took place eye to eye through thick glass over a telephone connection. It was by that means that I discovered that Holokechuk is not a dialect of definitely not Dingalic, and it's very distinct in a most crucial or definitive way from Cayucan, and that led to the establishment of another language identity in Alaska, for example. But this is 1962, thereabout. I guess I should also bring in a more personal thing. I was, although somewhat obliged to a woman in Iceland that I thought a lot of, I was a single bachelor when I came to Alaska, sort of. But within 1 month, after teaching about 1 month here, there was a gathering outside the room where I had been teaching French, and Rudy Krejci announced to me that my parents had just been in an automobile accident and were nearly dead already, and they soon died. I flew out to the funeral and to take care of family matters and the state. And at the funeral, Jane Lowell, an old friend from Cleveland who had been married and was then divorcing, came over to me and the rest is history. And we were married a year later, after her having accompanied me on my inspection tour of my assistants in the field work of that first summer of 1961 to Nondalton, where the guy from the University of Washington was working on Tanina, and to Anchorage, to Cordoba, where Austerlitz is working on EAC, and that photograph that shows Jane herself now dead, Austerlitz now dead, Irene Reed still alive, Lena Nachtan now dead, famous film, famous photograph, which is in the printed in a book in honor of EAC, and this was the beginning of Jane's introduction to Alaska. Charmed her enough to decide to marry me, and the rest is, I guess you could say, is history. That took place in connection with the first summer. We were actually married the following February while I was writing up the Minto results and writing the second year proposal. And that summer I did the definition of Athabaskan languages, or the survey of Athabaskan languages, and the others continued their work, Irene in Kodiak, Martha Still in Yupik, in a way, the research was in Alaskan Native languages was beginning to take shape. There was another element here that had begun with that too, but virtually the same time as I came, or even a little sooner, the Summer Institute of Linguistics Wycliffe Bible Translators opened a branch in Alaska in 1959, had some field training sessions there in Nenana, and in 1960 deployed people to St. Lawrence Island, David Chan, and to the Wich'in area, Dick Mueller, to the Cayucan area, Dave Henry, Constance Nation, Gillian Story, to the Tlingit area, a couple of years later, Ray Collins, to Upper Kuskokwim, in 1960, Don Webster, to Barrow, and a couple of years later, Wilfred Zibel to Kotzebue area. And although I had certainly had no habit of frequenting Christian missionaries, I did learn to work as well as I was fit in those days with people of that type too, so that it was kind of a challenge for someone whose social skills are at best mediocre to learn to deal with as wide a variety of my fellow Westerners, to include missionaries of various types, as well as academics and not to mention students, and of course with the many Alaska Native villagers that I consider some of my most meaningful relationships. Teddy Charlie and Minto, and Moses Charlie and Minto, for example, and later Peter John and Minto, and others there, and every single speaker of EAC, Marie Smith, who is still with us, and Lena Nakhtan and Annie Nelson Harry and Sophie Borodkin, and my old Mike Siwak, who was mostly blind and deaf, and so there with and George Johnson in Yakutat, and Annie Nelson Harry, as I mentioned, in Yakutat, and we'll mention much more in connection with EAC, and many speakers of Athabascan in most of the villages, and others in connection with the Yupik work. So that was a wonderful, rich experience. I was still the only academic linguist, full-fledged academic linguist, in Alaska, and it was a period, the 60s, I can generalize to say, where I was very much in demand, but at the same time not overwhelmed with distractions and too much going on. There was no interest in doing anything with the languages other than this strict research, even though our goals and ideas had always been gone far beyond that, although in the case of Athabascan survey and, of course, EAC, opportunities for community language program development were minimal, and compared with the opposite end of the scale, Central Yupik, where you still had a large group of people with a language that many children were still learning and so on. And I was keenly aware of this and of the sociolinguistics of everything. But there was not much one could do to, say, fight with the BIA or get language policies that were long entrenched and the university itself was still 100% going along with, to change anything, make any social changes, sociolinguistic changes. It was enough to persuade people that the languages were worth any attention at all, and that unlike the case of the Hebrides or parts of Ireland, was not a communist spy, neither a communist spy nor crazy, to want to do something or learn something about their languages. But it was certainly a new idea that was acceptable only in an academic sense and not in a very practical sense. Although I was very testing this all the time, and this had come with me, and say, in my mother's milk and in all the previous meaningful training that I'd had in Ireland and the Faroes, for example, were certainly all that happened to those languages, which were in a sense possibly potentially comparable. A language of 5,000 people, hell, Central Yupik was 15,000-20,000 at the time. By 1963, by 1962 I had pretty well made the most important contributions to the definition of Athabascan languages in Alaska and changes to comparative Athabascan in the purely academic field, although the results were not published till about 1964 and after that. I was always able to continue to get money to do the research. But I realized myself that from a research point of view, for me personally, that EAC was far and away the most important language for me to concentrate my efforts on. For one reason, because it was already very close to extinction. There were, at that time actually, five people who could speak more or less EAC. Marie, the youngest, Sophie, her sister, who was not easy to work with at the time, and was severely distracted with alcohol issues, and there were a lot of people there, of course. Lena Nactan, Annie Nelson, Harry, George Johnson, and to some extent Mike Siwak, who had some memory of the language, although distant. And I determined, since Austerlitz was not going to be able to continue this on a consistent basis, that I should turn my attention to EAC, and I spent, because of that, always supported, never by the university, of course, any of this research, but by strictly by NSF grants, which I continued to get through the 1960s to manage to document EAC, the story of which I will save for a separate tape, if I may. Mm-hmm. As I'm trying to keep a different kind of viewpoint here. But I was then very heavily preoccupied throughout the 60s with the task of documenting as much as I possibly could of the EAC language. There were two very obvious reasons for that. One, that EAC was already nearly extinct, but also that it is very definitively, very obviously not an Athabascan language at all, but rather the one and only first cousin to all the Athabascan languages as siblings of a different branch. So you have all the 30-some Athabascan languages as one branch, and then you have EAC, and EAC alone as the other branch. That whole two-branch family is in turn attachable to Tlingit, although that was very problematical and still is in certain ways, and at a much more distant, at a much greater distance in a certain sense. But at the same time, the EAC and the comparative Athabascan are close enough to be very enlightening to each other. The Athabascan languages are the result of maybe 2,000 years of divergence, or as though it were 2,000 years of divergence, back from Proto-Athabascan. The divergence between Proto-Athabascan itself and EAC is probably another 1,000 years before that. So that the Proto-Athabascan EAC common ancestor would go back an extra 1,000 years to something more like 3,000. Mm-hmm. And that's a very enlightening interval or distance, and we have only begun, you might say, to benefit from that, or profit from that from a purely academic point of view. And it may seem like it's purely academic, and in fact it is in a sense purely academic, but my belief is that in essence, ultimately, nothing could be more interesting to Athabascans themselves than the study of what is Athabascan, and that in essence is the Athabascan languages. The culture is far more diverse and dependent on environments, which range from frozen Alaska to parched desert in the southwest, Arizona, and even Mexico at times. And the but the languages are all very closely related, mutually enlightening to each other. And then all of those put together and EAC are also mutually enlightening in turn. So that, although seemingly academic, is, I believe, ultimately of very intrinsic worth to anybody who is Athabascan and cares what that means.
So that was this whole preoccupation was all through '60s.
Through the '60s, okay. I would say that was, in a sense, what was foremost in my mind, aside from what things I had to do for my bread and butter, and to work with the people working with Yupik. To keep up the Eskimo side of things in the department, and to lay the groundwork for the political advancement of the languages, first and foremost by trying to neutralize the negative effect of the schools and by getting them into the schools. And by the late 60s, all of this fits together rather well, just late 60s, because if you take, say, the 50s and the end of colonialism and the desegregation rulings and the 60s ensuing political or rather social unrest, especially civil rights issues arising from all of that, and somewhat later in the 60s, as liberalizations crept into the ideas of bilingual education in schools outside, especially Hispanic. And we worked closely with those people too. Not just following, but working with them to develop arguments for the introduction of bilingual education, not just in Spanish, of course, but in Alaska, in especially Alaska Native languages. And by 1968, we put together Irene Reed and myself, believe it or not, Arthur Hippler, who later turned into, who was a maverick in those days when everyone was wearing a suit and tie. He was a guy with a shirt, sleeves rolled up. And then later on turned into the opposite, and after everyone else went to shirt sleeves, he put on a suit and tie and became became a notorious figure in anthropology. But back in his liberal maverick days, he was part of it, and God help us, so was Don Webster, S.I.L., missionary from Barrow. This motley crew put together a proposal to Cliff Hartman, then the secretary or whatever you call him, commissioner of education for the state of Alaska, to introduce the use of Alaska Native languages in schools, most specifically Yupik, where we had a good writing system and there were hundreds of children whose first language it still was. And the answer that we got back from Hartman was barely polite, just another university egghead's scheme for making money and blah, 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 but especially, most of all, and here he was absolutely right, of course, this would totally undermine the authority of the teachers in the schoolroom, because the teachers, not knowing the native language, having a class going on in the native language would be exactly the unthinkable, impossible situation that they could never face, and would indeed cause a revolution in the schools as to who's in power. The beauty, however, and the constitutionality of it, which very vociferously pointed out, is that this is not in this way. Only Eskimos could get to teach Eskimo schools and so on. And I pointed out that that is not correct. The people of any race, religion, creed, color, are more than welcome to apply, provided they are fluent speakers of Yupik. That is not a racial thing. That is an intellectual thing. There are plenty of Yupiks who can't speak any Yupik. It's a matter of having a particular skill and not being of a particular race. True, statistically, most people who speak Yupik happen to be Yupiks, but it is still not a racial thing. Totally constitutional, totally moral and right. Up to then, of course, the hypocrisy of all this whole thing is shown by the fact that if a Yupik did get a teaching degree, he would never be allowed to teach in a Yupik school, but be sent amongst the Tlinkets or whatever instead, and vice versa. I think I mentioned that in the case of the St. Lawrence Island teacher. This was finally going to cause a very fundamental change in the whole purpose of education in Native Alaska. We were turned down, as I was saying, in a very nasty letter from Hartman, which I, a year later in 1969, in the late summer of 69, before I was headed off for my sabbatical at MIT, we were able to brandish this reply to the U.S. Senator Subcommittee on Indian Education, then visiting in the persons of Senator Ted Kennedy and Walter Mondale. They came to Scheibel Auditorium back then, and there was a real nice hearing that went on till wee hours of the morning, and I noticed that both Mondale and Kennedy were wide awake and taking it all in. There's all kinds of testimony was pouring in, including ours, about how we were turned down by this proposal, and they took all due note of that, and it was obvious that now, say between 68 and 69, as you're headed toward 1970, that times were changing and the society was becoming deeply unsettled, both by the human rights, especially civil rights and the issues in this country, and also by the Vietnam War, which for the first time was a war that not everyone agreed was the kind we should be fighting. And there were deep divisions and a lot of passion and a lot of radicalization going on finally in this latter part. And we were definitely in the thick of that. Then in the year 69-70, I decided to take a sabbatical and left the state to spend the year at MIT, where I had a visiting professorship with Noam Chomsky and Morris Halle and Ken Hale and some good friend there. And promised to be a very nice year, ostensibly to retread myself from a theoretical point of view. Can you stop this for a second? Because I need to get up and go to the bathroom.
The 70s, MIT.
Well, I was, going there.
Mm-hmm.
I left Alaska for that one academic year, in part for a change of scene, and in part to work at MIT, and in part to absent myself from a situation in Alaska where I had maybe outlived some of my usefulness as a proponent of bilingual education in Alaska Native languages, because of my lack of personal diplomacy and failure to charm the Bureau of Indian Affairs, BIA, or state-operated school system administrators with, I think the word had been used, were not was a harsh or strident complaints about what the educational system was doing to Alaska Native languages. And in my absence, Irene Reed, ever the smooth and diplomat, and Frank Darnell, founder of the Center for Northern Educational Research, and Smoothie, and I often describe him as a guy, I never saw it happen, but I would imagine that if the rose in the vase on your table were low on water, he would be the first person there with a pitcher to make sure that your rose is well nourished and that things are nicely done in ways that charm and people into doing things that I would never think of. And between Irene Reed and Frank Darnell, I believe there was a reception or something that they held for administrators of the state-operated schools and the BIA in the, well, still there on the third floor of the Eielson building, still as the home economics lounge where there were stoves for girls to learn to cook at and nice tables and so on. They held meetings there and persuaded the BIA especially and the state operated schools to experiment with the idea of using Alaska Native languages in the schools where the children knew the language better than English, to learn to read and write, for example, first in their own language, so that they would be learning to read and write a language that was the one they knew, their own, number one, and number two, much easier intrinsically thing to do than English, which has all kinds of extra baggage from centuries of orthographical chaoses and mixtures of rules from different languages. So PH, because of some strange language, is pronounced F. excuse me. So why do you have to spell fish, P-H-I-S-H, or do you, or something? UPIC doesn't have any such problems. Unfortunately, English does. And people could hardly understand why it would be, you know, how it could be so much easier. Anyway, Irene, and they were able to persuade these people, probably with a few phrases like, Krauss doesn't have anything to do with this, does he? Or something, it sounds a lot like. Oh, no, he's thousands of miles away at MIT and nothing to do with this. And anyway, they succeeded while I was away to persuade these agencies to experiment with this notion in four UPIC schools. Irene is also a wonderful kind of a mother hen type of person and talent scout, and with her extensive contact with UPIC people, was able to pick superb candidates to come to Fairbanks that following summer to train for this program, just as I was coming back from MIT. She had there up in the third floor in Islesen a whole workshop full of these eight trainees, two from four schools each, who had 8 weeks also of training that summer of how to read and write in their own language and to teach in their own language. But don't forget, they themselves had never had any opportunity to do that, or if they did, it was because for the most part they would have had some practice with the Moravian writing system for UPIC, and we tried to go along with that as close as we could, but we had to establish at the same time our own pan-UPIC orthography using the best traits of the Moravian, number one, of our understanding of the phonology, number two, the better traits of the Moravian and the Russian Orthodox to some lesser extent, and especially also Catholic. So, for example, for the sound of R, which is extremely common in all Eskimo languages, the letter R, which is otherwise not needed, was very natural to Europeans, French, German, and so on, as many of these Moravians and Catholics were. It was very natural, as it had already been the case in Greenlandic and Canada in a way, to use the letter R for so that went along with the Moravian and Catholic writing systems already anyhow. And the idea was that we would set a standard, not that it would deprecate any of the already extant writing systems, which churches were more than welcome to continue doing, but for the schools we needed one single writing system for the entire central UPIC area, and based this practical system on what we had done at the university scientifically, plus fitting it with the politically with the Moravian and the Catholic writing systems as much as possible. So that's a whole other kind of subject, but fundamental to the progress of the central UPIC programs, and the first programs, experimental albeit, in bilingual education in Alaska in those four central UPIC schools. And so that was the beginning of bilingual education. Another ingredient to that, incidentally, was some of the university courses that we had developed in the late 60s, one called the Eskimo Language Workshop, which was something like an advanced composition course for advanced writers in UPIC, in which many of the a group of the UPIC advanced UPIC students in the field began writing little storybooks, school books, literally or imaginatively, for their younger siblings still in school, and experimenting with producing little readers and primers and school books. The name of, again, of this course was UPIC Language Workshop, but that basically functioned as a kind of a cell of subversive plotting for the development and demonstration of good, sound writing system for the and sound reading materials for the children to learn to read with, provided the schools with a view toward getting them into schools or showing how the, that it could be done, the children could learn to read and write in their own languages using the, what we had developed, the orthography and these little reading materials produced by the students of the so-called Eskimo Language Workshop course. So it was later became institution of its own, Eskimo Language Workshop. Started out as a course called just that for advanced composition in the language at the university, probably in the year 1968 or 69. The first students started passing through that and developing the first prototypes of readers in the modern writing system. So we were doing the basic groundwork, especially Central Yupik, for the political battle of getting the languages accepted into the schools. Mm-hmm. And so that was 68, 69, 70, to describe. Then comes the year 70-71, the experimental program in Central Yupik expands. The student James Nariak, no, that was 71-72 or 70-71, from Barrow comes to the university, and he and I together, he was a student. I taught a course in his Inupiaq, using him as the chief source of information and teaching the students how to elicit that information about how the grammar of the language works so that it becomes a discovery procedure on the part of the students themselves. Back then, still maybe half of the students in that course were fluent speakers of Central Yupik, of Inupiaq, from the Kobak or Barrow. And it became a very interesting interaction between James, who knows the language very well, and the students, who also still knew the language well, and many students, white and native, who didn't, too. To discover how the language works through this intellectual process of rigorous examination of the grammar as directed by me, but done basically, or as provided, information provided by James, who was learning the process too. And this became a kind of a prototype also of this learning process, which doesn't go on forever in the sense that the courses eventually take shape and develop their own texts and dictionaries and so on. But back then we were starting relatively empty-handedly. But that, of course, I consider that a great triumph, and it was a wonderful year with myself and James running that course with some outstanding students. And this was the beginning then also of the second language in the Alaska Native Language Program. The time had come as things were becoming more and more polarized and militant about Vietnam and civil rights and so on, that Alaska being a little late in the game, although not that late, and through other contacts with the state-operated school system, for example, and a very important figure in this, Gary Holthaus, H-O-L-T-H-A-U-S, who at one time I think had been a minister. That was a big surprise to find that out. But at that time was the bilingual officer for the state-operated school system. Or not bilingual officer, but in the curriculum there anyway. And he and Joe Josephson drew up a bill for the state legislature, 71 for the 72 legislature, which did two things. I wasn't in on the actual writing of it, because it would have been different probably if I had, but they, I was just glad to see this, this finally taking place. And through the sponsorship of Joe Josephson and the diplomacy and commitment of Gary Holthaus to what is right, introduced a pair of bills into the state legislature. One mandating the use of the children's first language, where Alaska Natives, for example, come to school speaking Native instead of English, that they shall have a teacher in teaches in that language, and a curriculum in that language, and that including written materials in the language. And for any school where there are 15 or more such pupils, which took in a large number of Central Yupik schools, although not too many others, and the second bill, the twin pair to that, was that there shall be established at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks a, an Alaska Native Language Center, whose job it shall be to, one, and I'm paraphrasing this now, this is not quite literally, but one, quotes, study, end quotes, all Alaska Native languages, and number two, support the bilingual programs, give the basic academic support. That doesn't mean pay for, of course, or train everybody or do everything necessary for, but provide academic basis for the development of these programs throughout the state schools, through the schools in the state. And BIA went along with this, even though they were not technically legally bound to it, but they and at the same time during the 70s they were running fewer and fewer of the schools in Alaska. So we worked like hell through that whole year of first half of 1972 to get these bills passed. Because of the strength of the bilingual experiments that had been made in Central Yupik, it was possible to introduce this legislation and to lobby it through, because we had very successful and very favorable results from the few schools, Yupik schools, where the children were allowed to use their language. And there's a lot that I normally teach about, and of course I'm not going to go into that here so much, but that the children were afraid still to speak the language when they came to school, because they knew they were, as their older siblings had always been forbidden from doing that, and were punished, or there's always that threat, it was a scary thing to do. And it took the kids a couple of weeks to realize, no, it's okay to do it now, suddenly. And when that finally dawned on them, my God, they were different kids, mm-hmm. finally, after all these years. So this was a liberation, too little, too late, I admit, but still, obviously glad we did it. And even as little and as late as it was, I have to even confess that I was a bit surprised that it was possible to get through the state legislature these bills that soon.
So that was a state law or a federal
law? State law.
State law.
Yeah, the I neglected to say the federal law permitting bilingual education was passed in 1968. And that it became legal to do that by federal law in 1968, but the state law even mandated the use of the languages. Mm-hmm. Not that that has ever been always followed through or anything, but it certainly went beyond the federal law in its commitment to the use of native languages.
So the focus was on minority languages then? Generally, or only native?
No, it was on languages other than English.
Right, okay.
And it is possible that there have been schools where there are 15 or more students whose first language is really Japanese, Korean, conceivably Spanish, or God only knows, maybe even Albanian once or twice or something. There were a lot of Kosovars in certain, like Bethel at one time. So. But the main focus for us, of course, was native. But it didn't specifically state native, no. And I'm not going to try to go into, I think, the development of bilingual education throughout the state or anything like this, other than that it has spread to a certain extent in appropriate ways, failed to spread in some appropriate ways, and has spread in certain inappropriate ways where it doesn't work. But I'm staying out of that subject. That's a whole different subject, because it was in certain ways too little too late. By the time the children no longer speak that language as a dominant language, it's a very different problem altogether. But meanwhile, the Alaska Native Language Center was established at the same time, not only to support these bilingual programs, but also to quote, study the Alaska Native language. And by that, I've always taken to mean that meant to document these languages, not to study them in the sense that subjects of experiment to validate or invalidate directions in linguistic theory, quite the opposite. Just as subjects in their own right, as languages in their own right, they need to be documented, and nobody's invented a better way yet since Boas, as they call it, dictionary, grammar, and texts. Okay. And in its place, of course, as much phono video recording as possible too, but documenting the languages, sort of mean by that, and getting the dictionaries, all the words in the language insofar as possible, and everything you need to know about the grammar and everything is broad and varied a corpus of recording of the language in use and in various ways, and that classic definition of documentation is a main goal for what that part of the center's mandate is. And that's our kind of university research.
Mm-hmm.
There's something else I'm going to say about that. The center was established as part of the Center for Northern Educational Research under Frank Darnell, who happened to be away that year on sabbatical in England and only came back to find that it was part of his thing, which he, I trust, was happy to see. But I don't think he was too happy to see that he had me as an underling. It caused him, I think, maybe some discomfort. I should have realized that and reassured him that I wasn't going to cause him trouble. But I guess I was the only other person in there that might have vied for him, with him for power or anything, so he had to more or less make sure that I didn't get too uppity or the center get too uppity, with the result that as part of that center we were more and more crowded until the rest of the thing luxuriated in nice space for having tea and so on, a la Frank's experience in England. Until a fire marshal saw that we were so crowded together in a little slum of our own that it was too hazardous and we had to be accorded more space and so on. That was our second year. Our first year was where I still was in the, here's the part that I had meant to go into. I still was where we still were part of the Department of Linguistics and Foreign Languages. At this same period, there was a departmental meeting. I had, I think I said earlier, in about 1963 or 4, getting very tired of administrating this rapidly growing Department of Linguistics and Foreign Languages, and hired Bruce Gordon of the Emory University, had taught French and Spanish there, partly also to take over as department head, which I promptly installed him as. I hired him and set him up as a department head and just expected him to leave me alone. One of those, because my interest was strictly from, say, 64 on, it was practically all just native language, and I expected him to treat us fairly, and I'd even given up trying to teach the linguistics. In my absence while I was at MIT, he hired a Korean by the name of John Koo, who did not turn out to be very good, and certainly as a linguist. The less said about him, the better here, although I've said lots about him elsewhere. But Gordon sort of championed him. So that sets the stage for a department meeting in 1971 or 2, where I proposed the point that the name of the Department of Linguistics and Foreign Languages is not really very appropriate because it doesn't mention native languages. Native languages, although foreign to English, are certainly not foreign to Alaska.
Yeah.
They're the exact opposite, and that it's totally inappropriate to allow the department to continue under that name, since we also teach native languages, by then teaching both Yupik and Inupiaq. And that meeting, I said, we've got to change the name. How's about linguistics and foreign and native languages? No, that's not very, that's unwieldy or something. Well, what about then linguistics and languages? No, because it doesn't include English. And then, okay, what about linguistics and native languages? What? Well, okay, every 10 years we change it. So that's what it is, linguistics and foreign language for 10 years. been that way now for 10 years. Let's call it linguistics and native languages for another 10 years. No, we couldn't possibly do that. Well, then what should we do? Why not split into two departments? And in fact, it was John Koo who actually said that, himself hoping that he would go along with us. And he brought that up, and by the end of that meeting, we had decided to split into two departments. But I stupidly, this is another example of I ain't no Joe Stalin, instead of saying, John, you and linguistics are welcome to be with us, I let that go as a kind of to Bruce Gordon. I said, okay, you can be linguistics and foreign languages, and we'll just be native languages, and linguistics can stay with you. Okay. Partly because I didn't want to have to do anything to do with John Koo. I should have kept him and then axed him instead of allowed Gordon then to champion him and tenure him, which set linguistics back for a whole decade here at the university. But be that as it may, by far the most important thing was to get a separate department of native languages, and that was the beginning of the Alaska Native Language Program. And it turned out that very same spring, Alaska Native Language Center, which came from a new addition of state money, defined at $200,000 to establish the Alaska Native Language Center. To be honest, I don't know how it was that I officially became the director of it. It was just sort of an assumption. There was hardly anybody else to begin with, it was, taken for granted that I was the director and appointed as that, and then I so that's how it was established. So that takes it to the establishment of the Alaska Native Language Center.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we are back on.
All right. In 1972, when this bill was passed, the president of the university was still William R. Wood, who I had known since the very first day I came here, and the very first day he came here. We came here virtually the same day. I met his mother then well into her 90s, or over 100 or something at that time, who told me how she raised Bill, and she was a grand lady, and saw him inaugurated and all. Had conferred with him about the bill and the lobbying for it, and he was supportive, but we did the work, and but he was fully up with it, or knew what was going on, and always supported that, but then retired from the presidency the year that we just after we were founded. So he saw all that development, but no further. The status of the center, the finances were that this was an add-on to the university's budget, as it was an add-on to the university's responsibilities. Now the university is being is given $200,000 of state money to study and support bilingual programs in Alaska Native languages. Technically, this was legislative intent, which is, as I say, technically valid or obliges for 1 year only. And after that, the university can take the money and run it in any direction it wants. And it often does that kind of thing because the university is not, in fact, legally obliged to do what it said it's going to do with the money for more than 1 year. Whether that's ethical or so on is another story. But it's a matter of trust and the university's gaining or losing trust of the legislature, and we all sort of know where that stands for various reasons. But and here's perhaps the place to make that point. After Wood left, I think not since Wood left has there been an administration that has, I think, honestly done anything but abuse and exploit that money. That the basic pattern has always been to chisel away at it, never to, no matter what we say, never to increase it. The result is that now, after 32 years, since 1974, the budget of the center is $435,000, where barely to keep up with inflation since 1972, that $200,000 should be close to $900,000. It is now $400,000. And the reason it is even $400,000 is that on two occasions, after a 40% cut in 1986, I was invited by then Chancellor Patrick O'Rourke to make an end run on the university budget to the legislature and ask for more money for Alaska Native Language Center, which I did, and succeeded in getting in 2 years in a row for about $200,000 more. By that time, getting us with those 2 years in a row virtually up to where we should have been without given inflation. Otherwise, if I hadn't done that, our budget would now be more like $200,000 rather than $400,000. In other words, they, in a way, of that original $200,000, they have taken not half but three quarters. And that is along with the money that I went back and got to replenish the center from the predation of the university administration. And it's never been anything but that. With the somewhat minor exception, you might say, of the goodwill of Ann Shinquin when she was dean, and we came to her after 86 all bleeding from the chop. She gave us every bandage she had, but it was still only bandages. I mean, what the hell can the dean level do? The university level, especially UAF administration, has never been kind to the center, mm-hmm. but only abusive or exploitative. Many people are shocked to hear this, but the facts are the facts. Maybe people think, oh, the center's got such prestige, it can take care of itself. Yeah, sure. No, it can't. And especially when there's ill will, and there's plenty of ill will. And a lot of it is not on the surface. A lot of it is behind closed doors, because what we're talking about are racial and ideological issues that people do not discuss openly in front of me, for example. It's probably unhealthy, quite literally, for me to go extensively into this, there are those who have said to me that, what do you expect of a university, or the famous story about that, you know, with the snake who, I don't know, got a ride on a turtle or something, or and then bit the turtle, or, I don't know, you Greeks surely have
the scorpion and something else.
Well, and then in the end, he bites him. And I guess so he'll sink and die, and then the scorpion will drown too, or whatever. But the scorpion says, I can't help it, I'm a scorpion. And you know, what do you expect? I'm a scorpion. What do you expect? I'm a snake. And so what can, you know, why should... I'm sorry, I was sort of... Here I am, a fugitive from my own background, having taken refuge, I thought, in the one human endeavor that is not strictly mercenary, only to find that it's just as mercenary or worse and more hypocritical than most. Also, there's all kinds of racism working in both directions, including the reverse. So, you know, the Native Language Center, although it's true that we hire far more natives per department than any other, that's for damn sure. Nevertheless, there are whites there, and does a white have any right to do this kind of work? Maybe only people who should be doing this. Makes the university look bad if people doing this work don't have brown skins. And especially since it purports to be of a nature that is not merely academic, but is supposed to be, here we are, if we'd stayed academic, they would have let us alone. But no, here we are trying to work with the communities and there's all kinds of personal relations and weaknesses in the administration. I will not name the obvious names, but how broad this particular roadblock to our progress. Is the president's term was roadblock. There's obviously a roadblock. Whether he knew about it before or only found out about it after the fact, don't know. But it has been I'm sorry in a sense to have lived long enough to see it take such virulent shape. And but again, you know, it's partly my fault for being such a babe in the woods, or so stupidly naive to trust people that, you know, because they're quotes of a university administrator.
Right.
So, I'm not trying to even play sorry for myself, I'm just trying to make this point about the fact that this was a, you used the word gift, you could call it that, of the legislature to the university for this purpose, but yes, we have managed to survive, but that's only because of whatever mediocre ability I've had to fight the administration not to Right. Not because of the administration's kindliness, although God only knows they could have gotten rid of us entirely if they wanted to. But I think they've tolerated us as a source of income. And as a source of something that they can, once in a while, whenever it suits their purpose, claim to have done themselves for the natives, which in fact is a certain kind of hypocrisy, but it's better if I don't turn this or lower this into something as vile as it this aspect of it is.
So does this conclude this chapter of?
Well, no, I was just talking about the budget. With the money, the $200,000 we had there, I was able to hire top talent, although precious little of it in that had the typical academic certifications. In part because I think arrogantly believed that my own tip-top certifications like Harvard, PhD, blah, 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 gave it the respectability and credibility that it needed, and that with that I could hire whoever I want who could do the job the best. Jeff Lear, who is a definitely oddball character, who at the time didn't even have a BA, but had superb talent. I think I talked about that, or I should at some point. Phenomenal talent at working with Alaska Native languages. He now has a PhD, but that wasn't because I had him do it. And others. Dick Dauenhauer and his wife Nora. Dick is himself a PhD, but Nora is a Tlingit scholar, the first rank, and we had them on that first year. Others like.
Sorry to interrupt you, I have to change things.